This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cockfighting is a blood sport in which chickens fight it out while people make bets. Because it's illegal in many places and frowned upon even in some places where it is legal, the culture around it is somewhat secretive. My guest Burkhard Bilger has written a fascinating article about cockfighting, what the sport is like today, its history, and what it says about our culture. It's published in the current edition of Harper's. Bilger has also written for The Atlantic Monthly and The New York Times. He's a contributing editor of Health and deputy editor of The Sciences. I asked him why he wanted to explore the world of cockfighting.
Well, I was interested in kind of clandestine Southern traditions because I'd grown up in Oklahoma. My parents were academics, and I kind of lived in a standard American suburb and didn't have much connection to local culture, really. It was just kind of a sitcom existence in some ways. And at one point, I was looking through some strange magazines. One of them was called Feathered Warrior, which ended up being a national cockfighting magazine, and kind of discovered that it wasn't just a strange little subculture that had been outlawed long ago, but was a real vibrant thing. There were thousands of people doing it, even hundreds of thousands. So there were 500,000 of them, some people think. And just wanted to explore that and kind of get a sense of the life that I had missed growing up in Oklahoma.
Is there a lot of cockfighting in Oklahoma?
Yeah, there is. Definitely two of the biggest pits in America are there. One's called Mid-America. It's on the Arkansas border, and one's called Texoma on the Texas border. And Texoma's huge. It's this enormous amphitheater, and they gave $150,000 to the biggest winner last year and a truck to the cock of the year. So it's a huge, huge thing there.
Now, I've never seen a cockfight, and I imagine a lot of our listeners haven't seen one either. So why don't we get to a description of what a typical cockfight is like, if there is such a thing as a typical cockfight. Perhaps you can describe one of the cockfights you saw at the Red Rooster in Louisiana.
Well, the Red Rooster is a rickety little building in the middle of nowhere next to Maurice, Louisiana. It doesn't look like anything from the outside. There's barely even a sign. You go inside, and it's kind of all plywood, and everything's not square, and there's a little concession stand, and you walk in and you see kind of this miniature Thunderdome. It's this amphitheater of seats, kind of rickety benches, and the middle is this enormous two-story octagonal cage, which is made out of chicken wire, and it's elevated off the ground, and it's completely enclosed, and that's for a certain kind of Cuban cockfight where they just put the chickens in and leave, and they consider it the most natural cockfighting. But anyway, it's enclosed mainly to protect the spectators from the birds, which are wearing these knives on their heels in most cases. So the two handlers come in, and there's a referee in the middle who's wearing black and white stripes. And the handlers have to hold their chickens very tight in their arms because they're already pumped up. A lot of them get testosterone injections or digitalis to make their hearts race or any number of things to get them up for the game fight. And so they're really raging to go at each other. And the two handlers will stand side by side and kind of sway toward each other and let their chickens peck at each other for a while and get their dander up, so to speak. And then they'll put them behind two lines that are a few feet apart made out of cornmeal that are laid in the sandy floor of this cage. The referee stands in the middle and he'll say, "Pit," and then the handlers will let their chickens go. Up until then, it's all pretty straightforward and even paced, but as soon as they go, I mean, the chickens move at 1,000 times the pace of everybody else in the room. I mean, it's like warp speed compared to everything. And all you see is this huge flurry of feathers and slashing talons. And for a newcomer like I was the first time I saw one, it's almost impossible to see what's going on. But the people who really know what's going on and have kind of accustomed their eyes to it can see, you know, what's happening is that the roosters are jumping up and dipping their tails down toward the ground and then spinning their talons with these knives that are attached to the back of their heels down in a kind of a windmill pattern at each other. And if they're lucky, one of them will strike, you know, in the head or the eye or in the neck, and then they'll fall down again and the whole thing starts over again.
Now, what are the rules of cockfighting compared, say, to the rules of boxing?
In some ways they're the same. You know, they're rounds. Every time two chickens get tangled up, if their spurs or their gaffs get tangled in each other, they separate them, and the referee comes in there and puts them apart. And in some places, like in Bali, they'll drop a coconut, a pierced coconut, into a tub of water, and the time it takes for that coconut to sink to the ground, the chickens get to recuperate. And just like handlers in a boxing match, the cockfight handlers will take the chicken and talk to him and rub him and wash him off. And sometimes they'll stick his whole head in their mouth and suck the blood out or even spit into his beak to give him some refreshment. So in some ways, it looks like a boxing match. What's different is that a boxing match obviously has rules of sportsmanship. You know, you can't do rabbit punches and so forth. But a cockfight, there isn't any. It's once they're in the pit and they're going, it's no holds barred.
Do they fight to the death?
Yeah, they always fight. I mean, they don't necessarily fight to the death. If a chicken dies and the other one is won. But essentially, they fight until one of the chickens dies or one of them runs away or refuses to fight anymore.
Now, are there ways of playing dirty within cockfighting? I mean, you've told us what the basic rules are. Are there...
Oh, there are innumerable ways to play dirty. I mean, the people in Louisiana I talked to said that that never happens, but there are a lot of kind of ingrained rituals around cockfighting just to prevent that. For instance, in Venezuela, on the island of Margarita, people there are famous for using stingray poison and putting that on the blades of their cocks before a fight. Or they'll throw poison into chickens' food. Or in the Philippines, you know, I've read that sometimes handlers have been known, while the other handler isn't looking, they'll reach over and just snap a little bone in another cock's back, you know, tiny bone, just to cripple him a little bit. There's one famous story from the Philippines of, you know, a local mayor went to visit another district, and he went to a big cockfighting ring. And Philippines cockfighting is enormous. It's really the national sport, and it affects local politics and all this kind of thing. And the mayor went to visit another cockpit and had his own chicken, and he was fighting it, and the chicken was losing. And the mayor just jumped into the ring, pulled out his .45, and blasted the other chicken out of the ring. And people said, "What are you doing? This is cheating." He goes, "Well, no, my chicken didn't lose. He was never killed by the other chicken." And of course, he had 10 bodyguards with him, heavily armed, and everybody said, "Well, you're right. Actually, that's new. It's a new wrinkle. I never noticed that before." So there's a lot of ways to cheat.
Now, what's the state of cockfighting in America? Where is it legal? Where is it illegal?
Well, that's just changed recently. In the fall, up until the fall, it was illegal in every state, usually a felony or a misdemeanor, except in 5 states, and those were Oklahoma, Missouri, Arizona, New Mexico, and Louisiana. But last summer into this fall, in Arizona, Missouri, a huge referendum took place where volunteers gathered over 150,000 signatures, and this fall they were made illegal in both those states. So now the only places it's legal are Oklahoma, Louisiana, and New Mexico.
I imagine that in some places it's very controversial. How do the sides typically break down?
It tends to be, I mean, it's hard to say, because the natural answer to that would be animal rights activists on the one hand and cockfighters on the other. That's kind of deceptive, because in some ways, in a place like Louisiana, for instance, you know, there are a lot of congressmen who are pro-cockfighting, who think of it as a real Louisiana tradition and think that if you get rid of it, you're getting rid of something like the Mardi Gras. I mean, I had a friend who I met there, an academic, who said, you know, they'll sooner get rid of Little League than they'll get rid of cockfighting in Louisiana. But it tends to be animal rights activists tend to be the goads to get the laws passed. And the fact of the matter is, for the most part, if you can get a state petition that says, "Do you agree with cockfighting?" almost anyone will say no. And so that has been the best mechanism for outlawing in this country.
Yeah, so, the cockfighting is very controversial. You weren't used to going to cockfights. Give us a little bit of what the atmosphere was like in the places that you went to. I mean, is it a real, like, bloodlust type of sport?
Well, for some people it is, I'm sure. I mean, I think the atmosphere varies from the small pits to the big pits. I mean, when I went originally the first time, I went to that brush pit, Red Rooster, at midnight, and it was a thunderstorm, and I was terrified because I'd heard cockfighting always comes with drug sales and gambling and all kinds of nefarious activity, and that if you go there, you're among bad apples and all this kind of thing. So I originally was fairly frightened, and I get there, of course, and it's completely the opposite. In the small pits, the atmosphere is amazingly homey. I mean, you get there, And the night I went, it was, by the time I got there, it was about 1 in the morning. And there were two mothers nursing their babies right next to that big cage. There were toddlers running up and down the aisles. There were teenagers loitering around sipping Cokes. And it was very much, you know, family night. It was like going to a PTA meeting. It was very weird. And there, I would say, most people kind of went just for that. They went because, well, this is what everybody did on a Friday night or a Saturday night, and they like to be together. I talked to a sociologist later who said that cockfighters are kind of a frozen demographic. They're like the American from the 40s or 50s still living in these little tiny pockets. You know, they tend to be rural and small town and church-going and, you know, American as apple pie. So that's the small pits. But the big pits, those are a completely different scene. I mean, I went to one where there were 900 chickens fought in one night, and there was a $40,000 purse. And, you know, people drove from hundreds of miles around. They paid $16 to sit there. And that was really a gambling scene. It was, people really didn't care about the chickens. They came with a lot of money. They wanted to see their chickens win. They wanted to leave with a lot of money. And it was also fairly, I mean, 900 chickens in a day. You can imagine there's blood everywhere. There are chickens by the end of the night. There are just broken chickens overflowing out of the trash cans, lying in the aisles. They tend to be very rickety structures because no one really trusts that cockfighting will be legal for very long. So they are these kind of claustrophobic, poorly built, you know, fire trap buildings with hundreds of people screaming out their bets. It's not a really pleasant atmosphere.
What happens to the dead or the injured chickens after a cockfight? Are the dead chickens given proper burials? Are they eaten? And what about the chickens who are just, you know, terribly wounded? Are they nursed back to health or abandoned?
There's a whole discipline of cockfight surgery which comes into play for the wounded chickens. And if you can revive a bird, you will. And if it's a bird that has shown itself to be game, it just happened to get a tendon cut or something, yeah, they'll revive it. The ones that get killed, it used to be, and in some countries this is still true, that they'd eat them. In Louisiana, they'd eat them with a sauce de brie piquante, which was special dead cockfight kind of sauce. It was very good. That doesn't happen anymore. They give them all these drugs that are carcinogenic now, so they can't. That's ended. Now they just throw them away.
My guest is journalist Burkhard Bilger. His article on cockfighting is published in this month's Harper's. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Burkhard Bilger. He's written an article on cockfighting, published in the March edition of Harper's. I don't know a lot about the history of cockfighting or about roosters in general, but, I mean, are roosters naturally as combative as this? Is there a special breed of rooster that's used for cockfighting?
At this point, there are a number of different breeds. I mean, they all descend from Gallus gallus, the jungle fowl, which comes from Southeast Asia. And those are mean birds. They're the nastiest birds in the world, some people think. The males, you know, have acres of ground that they rule as their territory. And so if another male comes onto their territory, they try to tear them apart. So roosters, you know, even roosters in a chicken factory or on a free range, We'll kill each other sometimes. People call it coming into their pride. You know, if there's a rainstorm or some weird atmospheric change, they'll just start hacking at each other. So chickens do have that in them. The cockfighters tend to have done a lot of genetic manipulating to increase that bloodlust. Mm-hmm. They've taken Bankiva chickens from, I think, from Southeast Asia, and Malay chickens that have all kinds of different fighting attributes, and crossbred them. They've done all kinds of genetic research. I mean, your typical cockfighter is a postdoc when it comes to chicken genetics. They know everything about alleles and crossbreeding. And then they give them drugs, and they do all kinds of things just to emphasize that fighting spirit.
You know, cockfighting sounds so, grotesque and violent and... You write that our forefathers were cockfighters. Jefferson had game cocks. You say Andrew Jackson was fighting cocks on the White House carpet. Lincoln was a former cockfighting referee. So there's this whole, like, American history of cockfighting, huh?
I mean, cockfighting, you know, there was a time when it was called one of the most fashionable amusements of American culture. It was the national pastime for a while in the 19th century. it was extremely popular. Not just those guys, but Grover Cleveland fought Gamecocks. Woodrow Wilson gave plaques to cockfighters in the White House. There's even secondhand stories that Ronald Reagan, people on Ronald Reagan's ranch used to have cockfights in his ranch houses. I mean, there's this kind of, it's almost like a Thomas Pynchon novel. It's a secret history. If you start looking at cockfighting, it threads its way all through American history. But it was a mainstream amusement for most of the 18th and 19th century. And in England before that, clergymen used to stage cockfights and give prayer books as awards to the best cockfights. I mean, Henry VIII had a huge, sumptuous cockpit built with special gilded cock cages for all his lords and so forth. So it has this kind of prestigious history that got abruptly cut in this country around the beginning of the 20th century.
And what changed then?
I think two things. It kind of got attacked from two angles. One is the what they call the anthropocentric angle, which is said basically that cockfighting is bad for people. That you go to a cockfight and you're with a bad element, and you're engaging in bloodlust, and you're emphasizing all the worst human attributes. And the other one, of course, was the rise of the Humane Society movement in the end of the 19th century, which just gradually, I mean, that was really much weaker than the former argument, but it ended up being the one that really killed cockfighting.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were interested in the ethics of cockfighting, so you spent some time at a regular chicken farm, the kind of chicken farm where chickens are born to lay eggs for our breakfast and to create chicken meat for our dinners. And compare the conditions that you found on that big chicken farm with the conditions that you found on a farm that raises chickens for cockfighting. Or roosters, I should say.
Yeah. Well, the farms where they raise cocks tend to be, I mean, by chicken terms, you know, they're like luxury resorts, which isn't to mean that, you know, that there's, you know, bronze and gilt everywhere, but every cock has his own cage, his little conical cage with a long walking strip in front of it. They have these tenders that come by and rub them down every morning and give them special feeds and exercise them. And if they get too antsy, they'll bring in these plump little pullets and have them kind of work out their desires with another chicken. It's just, it really is. If you're a chicken, you want to be a cock, a game cock, because... And they'll live much longer. They'll live 1 to 3 years in most cases. Now, you compare that to a chicken factory. I mean, I went to one in Little Rock, which is a Tyson chicken factory. And Tyson is no worse than any of the others. They have a very, very efficient chicken-raising business, and we all reap the benefits of that. I mean, chicken used to be the luxury meat in this country. It was more expensive than lobster. It was more expensive than filet mignon. When people said a chicken in every pot, it was because it was considered so outrageous that would ever come true. And it has come true, and it's come true because of the way people like Tyson raise chickens. It would take 16 weeks for a chicken to reach 2 pounds. Now it takes 6 weeks for a chicken to reach 4 pounds. I mean, genetics and nutrition and just raising methods have increased incredibly. But of course, the dark side of that is the life of the chicken. I mean, you go to a Tyson factory, and there are these enormous sheds, and they're just tens of thousands of chickens crammed into a shed together, shoulder to shoulder. They spend 6 weeks in there, and that's not so bad, really, because it's kind of social, at least. But that's their life. That's the best part. Then they get crammed into trucks, 7,000 at a time, carried to this factory, and dumped on this enormous conveyor belt, which is a few feet wide, which just rolls them up into the maw of this factory. And they get there, and I mean, the guy who led the tour, I'm so grateful that he even took me there, because most chicken PR people don't want you to see these factories. They just want to keep you away. But he reluctantly agreed to take me into the killing zone. And you go in there, and it's almost pitch black except for some black lights. And the workers have top 40 music screaming, and the machinery is incredibly loud. And the workers just pluck these chickens off this conveyor belt and reach them up very quickly and hang them by their feet from this running chain that whips by overhead very fast. And so the chickens are hanging upside down. They get whipped over into the next room. And that room is a weird room. It's lit kind of like, I mean, the one I saw was lit like a Dutch painting, you know, just a one light bulb in the corner. And the chickens come hurtling through, and they come into these mechanical bottlenecks where their heads get squeezed together, and an electric shock gets jabbed into their head, and they get stunned. And then as they hang limp, a rotary saw comes and slashes their head off. And, you know, a few chickens will raise their heads and get away, but then somebody reaches over and cuts their throat with a knife. So it's, you know, if you had your choice between dying in a battle in a cage or dying that way, I think it'd be a fairly hard choice, but most people would probably pick the cockfight.
Burkhard Bilger's article on cockfighting is published in the March edition of Harper's. He's at work on a book about clandestine Southern traditions. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Burkhard Bilger. His article about cockfighting is published in this month's edition of Harper's. The article that you wrote for Harper's on cockfighting is actually part of a larger project that you're doing. You're writing a book on clandestine Southern traditions. What do you mean by that?
I mean, I'm interested in traditions that are like cockfighting that tend to be rural and have a lot of history to them and are interesting in that sense. Is they're a rich subculture, and they tend to be outlawed or illegal. And the reason, more often than not, tends to be say a lot about our values and how they've changed in the course of, you know, American history. Another example is a thing called noodling, which I wrote a piece for The Atlantic about. And that's where you hand grab catfish with your hands. You just, in the spring, you walk along a riverbank and you stick your hand into a hole and then you wiggle your fingers. And if a catfish is in there nesting, he'll bite your hand. And so you'll jam your arm down its throat and pull up this fish on your forearm, and it's a way of catching catfish that is very old, and the Indians did it, and it's been around forever, but it's outlawed in almost every state. And the reason is people say it's unsporting. And again, it's a kind of an example. It doesn't really make any sense to say it's unsporting. It doesn't make any ecological sense. It's just kind of a judgment we pass as a culture because our values are urban and no longer rural. And so I'm interested in traditions like that, that kind of put those things in perspective.
Your official paragraph-long biography says that you have a coonhound named Hattie. Is the coonhound part of your interest in these clandestine Southern practices?
Oh, yeah. She's kind of she was the goad who got me into it. I think when I was living in Boston, I was kind of nostalgic for my Oklahoma roots, and I decided to buy a coonhound, which I'd always seen on country roads and so forth. So I started to look around for one. I couldn't find one. And so I made a lot of calls and finally discovered a guy who bred blue tick coonhounds in Massachusetts. And I went to visit him, and I told him that I wanted to buy a red bone coonhound. And he went and he lifted up his hand. He said, just a second. He went in his house, and he came back with American Cooner magazine, which is just the weirdest magazine I've ever seen in my life. I mean, it's an inch thick. It has 100,000 subscribers. It's full of pictures of dogs jumping up trees and advertisements for chilled semen. You know, everybody's shipping their chilled semen all over the country. It's like, well, where did this come from? And since when is there this huge coon hunting subculture? And so I started to make calls, and I ended up writing a piece on coon hunting, and that's going to be one of the chapters in the book. And it really kind of introduced me to the interest. I mean, coon hunting is another thing. People go out in the middle of the night, every night. I mean, I hung out with a woman who coon hunts 350 nights a year. And every night at midnight, she goes into the woods and she stays out till 5 in the morning. And most of that time, she's just standing in the forest listening to her dog run down raccoons. It's just the strangest sport in the world. And yet it's wonderful. And it's once you get into it, it's kind of addictive.
So just to clarify, me being a northern urban person, in coon hunting, the dogs track down raccoons and chase them up trees?
Yeah, I mean, professional coon hunting is a very different thing from what coon hunting used to be. I mean, there's a book called Where the Red Fern Grows, all about this kid hunting down hundreds of raccoons and killing them. And most people think that's what coon hunting is, but professional coon hunters don't kill raccoons anymore. What they do is they gather in groups of four, and they go out for about 3 hours with a judge, and they just see who can chase the most raccoons up a tree in that space of time.
So now that you're deep into all these hidden Southern practices, you're living in Brooklyn, New York.
Oh, yeah, the epicenter of clandestine Southern traditions.
Yeah, absolutely. So I imagine there's a fair amount of cockfighting there.
There's a huge amount of cockfighting in Brooklyn. I mean, there's so many Latin and Asian immigrants. And, you know, of course, there's Santa Ria and so forth. So there's plenty of chickens around.
Are the cockfights in Brooklyn different from the Southern cockfights?
I assume they are. I mean, I honestly have never been to a Brooklyn cockfight. So I don't know absolutely. From reports I've heard, they're very much like the Red Rooster cockfight, except they're more makeshift because it's illegal. There was a famous bust about 3 years ago in Harlem of a kind of a state cockfighting championship. And it was an amazing thing. They took an old theater in Harlem, and it was dilapidated, and they built all these false walls. And behind them, they had surgery rooms and drag pits, and they built a whole pit system. And the police confiscated hundreds of birds and arrested hundreds of cockfighters. So it's very active in New York.
Now, you've said that you think the reason why some of these Southern traditions are disappearing, like cockfighting or noodling, is that urban values are replacing rural values. And I'd like you to explain what you mean.
I guess cockfighting, if you look at the evolution of cockfighting, that's the easiest way to see it. I mean, essentially, states that are rural still, the most rural states are the ones that held on the longest to cockfighting. And the ones that are the most urban most quickly saw it as just kind of an aberrant activity. I mean, to us nowadays, the idea of a cockfight in the city just, it makes no sense to us because we don't even see chickens. The notion of animals being killed, it's so distant from our thinking that it doesn't really fit in with our value system. Whereas people in the countryside, my wife, her parents grew up on a farm in Nebraska, and they had to kill chickens themselves. It's not a big deal to them. It makes sense to them that this would be part of it. So that change, more than anything, has spelled doom for some of these traditions. When I was living in California when I was a kid, when I was about 9 years old, we used to have chickens in our backyard in this little suburban house we had. And we had some young roosters, some stags, who were just born when we moved in, and they used to make the most incredible racket at night. It was amazing, just screaming at night. And a policeman came eventually and arrested them for disturbing the peace and took them away. And to me, they always remind me a little bit of Wyatt Earp. You know, he retired eventually in L.A. in the city and kind of was there, this gunfighter, kind of hanging out in the big city watching his culture disappear. I think the chickens kind of reminded me a little bit of that. There were these last gunslingers in the suburban neighborhood.
Well, Burkhard, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Burkhard Bilger's article on cockfighting is published in the March edition of Harper's. He's at work on a book about clandestine Southern traditions. This is Fresh Air.